It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mod Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Hello again, Interior Alaska listeners. Welcome to another episode of Alaska Tracks, the program where we listen to excerpts from interviews with veteran outdoorsmen and women. I'm Randy Zarnke, and I'm your host of the program. Today's episode will feature Bob Ewell, who grew up in California, but knew from a young age that he was destined for other things. His enlistment in the Army brought him to Alaska shortly after the end of World War II. He stayed in the Great Land and lived a subsistence lifestyle with his wife and her Eskimo family in the small village of Shosholik, northwest of Kotzebue. Let's listen in as Bob relates the story.
My birthplace is Sacramento, California, and I went through grade school in Northern California and high school in Central California, Frisco Bay area, and was drafted right out of high school. I'd been outdoor-oriented most of my young life. At that time, our government came up with a great idea that if you were willing to sign up for 3 years, they would give you a choice of theater and branch of service. I chose Alaska for theater and infantry for branch of service, which would seem to most a kind of a dumb choice, but for me it turned out well. There turned out to be no other infantry outfit in Alaska except the remnants of the 1st Combat Intelligence Platoon, the Alaska Scouts, that a lot of people in Alaska have heard about. Kastner's Cutthroats is another name for them. They were instrumental in the Aleutian campaign, and they were made up of trappers and Eskimos and outdoor people from the state of Alaska. It was a especially interesting group for me. They had nearly 500 sled dogs at Fort Richardson and Anchorage. They did their own fishing for the dog feed for those. But here was I, 19 years old or so, thrown in with a whole bunch of people that had really operated in the outdoors in Alaska, which of course is different than California even in those days. But it turned out to be great for me. That particular outfit was still doing unusual things like making extended trip during the summertime. One of the summer trips after I got into the outfit was go up the river from Bethel to the portage area where the Yukon and the Kuskokwim come together and do some mapping for the portage. At that time there was a talk of making a canal there since the Kuskokwim is deep water. Anyway, we were sent in as an early group to do some map work. The summer after that, the two midget tugs and hauled them on the railroad to Nana and put the tugs in the river there, and then we went all the way down the river and then up to Nome. The purpose was to check Russian infiltration when there was a lot of feeling towards Russia. But anyway, all that to me, you can imagine, was one of the great causes of forming my later life, live off the land as it were. After 2.5 years, the government come through again with a great idea that anybody that had made that choice of taking a regular 3-year hitch, if they did want to be period of military, they could. By that time, they were stabilizing in numbers, and so they could be that kind of lineage. But it all worked right into my plan. The 1st Combat Intelligence Platoon was broken up, disbanded, because you had a bunch of fairly rough and wild and woolly people and not enough to keep them busy to keep them out of trouble. We were transferred into 10th Rescue, at least I was, and a number of others. That winter, this would have been up to winter of 48, established in Kotzebue an Arctic indoctrination school. Air Corps wanted to send all their officer personnel through this Arctic indoctrination school. They land in Kotzebue one day, sleep in a ready-made snow house that first night, and the next day they were required to make their own snow house and survive the night in it, and then they were free to go back to town. This, of course, involved all Air Force flying personnel, which by that time I had achieved the great rank of a buck sergeant. They chose those of us that had been part of that Eskimo Indian and trapper group to be the cadre. We were on place to take care of the folks that come in and put them through that particular training. And, of course, that kind of went to your head, being the one in charge of all the colonels and stuff. They had to sleep on your snowshoes for a mattress and that kind of thing. It was pretty harsh, but it was an interesting adventure. During that time in Kotzebue, I met Carrie, who's Eskimo, and her background is of people here where we are now. The Eskimo word she told us, this place here, is place of white whales, because the whole village of Noatak used to come down intact and camp over here for beluga whale driving way back the time. There were no outboards, no engine, but under oar power kayaks and that sort of thing. We were married in May of 48, and her parents raised 10 kids. they were not involved very much in the beluga situation here. This is their summer camp where they came for fishing after moving here from Seeding Point. It's down the line here, the tip of Cape Krusenstern. These people were oriented around bearded seal hunting. Ugu hunting was their mainstay of survival. All this impressed me pretty greatly because you remember the timing here. Hiroshima had just been bombed that previous year at my age, 19. Things didn't look all that great on the world scene. And then here, coming in contact with a group of people that had brought up 10 kids to adults with no money at all. The only money here was from trapping and for cannery work. A little later on, some construction work was going to Fairbanks. So there was just no money in the Kotzebue area from any purpose at that particular point in time. But what impressed me was this complete independence of money. And if they could do it, of course, being young and fairly tough, I needed to find out how they managed to do it. And I had good teachers. Carey's family took me in. At that time, their main source of local income was local seal oil trade. You'd put up more seal oil than you need yourself in season, 2-3 months of marine mammal harvest. And that's when they did move back here to Shisolik for salmon fishing. That's how I got involved in it. I had good teachers. Her family was. We got scolded one time. I, of course, couldn't speak Eskimo, and my wife's dad had lived with missionaries for some time, and he was quite proud of his ability to speak English. I was full of questions, naturally, and every time I asked a question, he would explain the question real well in English to me and be proud of it. That made him feel good, and it made me feel good, too. But his wife, Carrie's mother, broke into that one day and said, "You're making a mistake there, old man. You should respond to him in Eskimo, and he would soon learn to talk Eskimo." And that's true. And I've gone these many years, I still can't carry on a conversation in Eskimo. I, of course, recognize phrases and words and names of everything all right, but I'm still not fluent in Eskimo. But she pinpointed the reason right there. I eventually was able to do just about everything that you're supposed to be able to do at that age if you were a young Eskimo, which includes mostly bearded seal knowledge and hunting and...
Tell us how you go about hunting the bearded seals.
You enter a different world. It's a world of ice, ocean ice, and as soon as you move off the ground, you're out in a completely different environment. Of course, the bearded seal is a part of that environment, and there's other things like polar bears and common seals, and later on, spotted seals, and once in a while, a walrus. You have to come to know a whole lot of things in order to be able to gain anything, let alone surviving in that kind of an environment. But it is in the best part of the year. You don't start in the harvest on that until the latter part of April and early May, and then you spend the next 2 months out on the ice most every day, day and night. You find very little time to sleep. At that time of year, the bearded seals, common ring seals, are all coming up on the ice to bask in the sun, and one of the first things you have to learn is what the difference between a common seal and a bearded seal, because the bearded seal is the prize that everybody wants. That, of course, is what the whole culture used to walk on. I mean, there was no other leather. The hide of bearded seals made the mukluks and moccasins for everybody. That since there was no money, even though there were shoes, of course, and nobody had money to buy shoes, so it was pretty important. Along with this hide, which went for foot leather, you have a layer of blubber. Blubber, of course, turns to seal oil. The oil is stored into whole seal skin, made watertight, 200 pounds or 250 pounds from a large seal, and put handles in those, and they could be traded then for, at that time, what was fairly large money. But they're traded locally. You never had any trouble selling here in Fukushima. But that was what your monetary income came from. Hunting a bearded seal, you spend a lot of time up on higher points, icebergs, scanning with binoculars or a telescope, if you are lucky enough to have one, looking for. It's not hard to see seals laying on the ice, but how to tell the difference between a bearded seal and a common seal. And the difference, of course, is several hundred pounds. A common seal runs, 150 pounds. An extremely large one might go 200, but a bearded seal normally is between 500 and 800 pounds. So they're a much larger animal. Their habits are different. The main problem is spotting one laying on the ice. But if you do spot one, I soon learned, the Eskimo people that are around you that I was learning from don't have much sympathy for letting one get away, either wounded or whatever, are lucky enough to spot them laying on the ice at that season. By being cautious enough, you're supposed to get close enough so there's no danger of losing the animal. And that means a neck shot, because they're laying, of course, right next to their hole in the water, and any cripple don't mean to get in the water and be lost. And the habit at that time, I remember, with the Eskimos, even with the high cost of ammunition and the lack of money, was to shoot each ooh twice. You shoot it the first time, and if you come anywhere near where you're supposed to hit it, well, the head will flop forward, then firing a second shot right into the neck area. And that was kind of a sign of person success in those years, from a distance, if you hear somebody shoot it, boom, boom, you got it, ooh. Then, of course, you have to get it home, and that's a whole other story. This was all done by dog team, and of course, it was before snow machines. It was done clear through till ice breakup time, and at the latter end of it, you would drag your own sled and kayak on it onto the ice, and you would still be looking for a group somewhere. You would find one, and you would shoot it, and then if there's a lot of water by that time, you have to cut a hole in the group's breast area and then blow it up, just like a football, blow air into it, and you could roll it into the water then and tie, wrap around it with your kayak, and then you would paddle that home. And all that is not done anymore, of course. There's still a demand for the oil, not at all for the skins anymore, but the oil is still valuable. Everybody in the region that has an Eskimo household still has seal oil with their meals all the time. The one other source of money in the region was from furs. So you just quite naturally become a trapper, whether you wanted to or not. You might think you're doing these things because you wanted to, but after time they become a necessity. You have to have some money income. Everybody was hooked on tobacco, sugar, coffee, and all that stuff. To get that, you have to have some sort of income. Of course, fur has always been a source of money over the years. In this particular country that I found myself in, has never been a real good trapping country. There just isn't enough species of animals here. Things went pretty well here back in the 20s and 30s because it is red fox and white fox country, but all other species of fur in this particular area, especially on the coastal portion of it, the other species, mink and otter, of course, are represented here, but they're not many. There are only a few. Carey's brothers found a pretty good income at that time from hunting foxes. But the method of catching foxes amongst that group of people had nothing to do with trap. For the most part, you find a fairly fresh fox track, and at the end of that track, there's a fox. Snowshoes, sometimes skis. In those years, nobody bothered setting traps for foxes.
They just walk them down.
Right. Like hunting anything, you get to be an expert at that if you work at it. One of the big things about trapping anyway, it gives you an excuse to be out amongst the animals and the outdoors. It allows you to learn a whole lot about them. Now, in that era, stuff like flour, sugar, were very cheap at the local stores. And good red fox, you might get $150, $200 for, and you get a whole sled load of stuff from the store. What happens in those years then, for the most part, is that since you're always on the lookout for any kind of fur, and of course you did have trap, if you find an indication there's three or four mink using a certain lake area, why, you would set traps for them. That's what you'd usually end up the year with, is if you got three or four mink, well, you'd be pretty lucky in this area here. Now, don't misunderstand, there are good mink hunting countries back up the river, you know, Kobuk, Chelawik. They're fairly famous among locals for their mink and muskrat, of course, later on.
I admire Bob's matter-of-fact manner of storytelling. He doesn't embellish his tales in an attempt to impress the listener. He just tells the amazing stories as if everybody lives the same lifestyle. Let's take a break here for a word from our sponsors. Okay, we're back. Thanks to those sponsors for helping us bring this program to you. Now let's return to our interview with Bob Ewell. In this next segment, Bob talks about the birds and fish and marine mammals that his family relied on for food. He also shares his views on habits and population changes of the belugas of Northwest Alaska.
And all this is a dog team, remember. We're not even close to the snow machine changeover here when everybody changed their technology. Those that had strong teams and a lot of ambition would make long trips back up to head to Noatak area where there are wolves and, of course, wolverine. And wolves and wolverine have always been an attractive animal because usually the local price that you would get for a good wolverine skin or a good wolf skin was almost twice that as you would expect from Goldberg's, that is, on the world market. I suppose you recognize the name Goldberg, and everybody had marketed their furs either through the stores or through Goldberg's. It was big in those years. other fur bearers that build up here, Lynx is one of them. When I first did get active here and see what animals were around and all that, there were no lynx around at all. But that rabbit population started to build, the lynx population started to build, and the older say that the last time that they died off, where there was lynx all over the country, some women even caught them by throwing their parkie over the top of them, way out of typical timbered habitat where the lynx are supposed to be. But during the era that I was active, the lynx did come back, and I took as many as 18 from our winter camp here. I never traveled too far. You're a little limited. We had an 8-dog team, and you usually have to keep 10 dogs in order to keep an 8-dog team, but everybody had that size of a team that was used mostly for hauling wood and hunting caribou or seal hunting in the springtime, all that kind of thing. But it was not a team that you would want to take off on a pure wolf or wolverine hunting trip way up to Upper Noatak or something like that. So you're kind of limited in the range you could cover in those years. This is a summer camp here. Will you move over here to these outlets in the fall time for whitefish? Just 2 days ago, this outlet over here closed. Every year, there's a big flood of whitefish that come down with breakup waters and enter these lagoons. It's a feeding run is what it is. There's a whole lot of bugs and mosquito larvae down there, and they fatten up right away. But the fish don't want to be stuck down there for the winter either. Their normal spawning areas are up in the river corridor. It's deep water. And so around the 4th of July, they fattened up down there and gotten real nice and fat, too fat to make dried fish out of. They're in very good quality cooking fish. But they move back through here. But in the meantime, the waves, like a couple, 3 days ago, throws gravel over the outlets of numerous these various coastal lagoons here and just plugs them up, and that traps the fish in there. If that situation happened around the 4th of July like it did this year, well, you're exceedingly happy, because there are just tons and tons of fish trapped in there that you can take them out at leisure when air temperature is cool enough to handle them. All you got to do is dig a ditch in the gravel and the fish run out water and just lay over, and you pick them up and put them in a sack. And there's tons of eyelets, and gunny sacks are just ideal for making Eskimo caulk from whitefish. And of course, you just stand at the bottom of these ditches at the outlet, throw these nice big fat fish into the sack, sew up the sack, and roll the sack aside. Now that in late September you do that, and of course they're good for the coming year then. The people who lived at these various places, so all the kids, small and large, are there with you. Of course, there's weasels that come around to eat on the fish scraps that are around there. Later on, there's foxes, too. White foxes have always brought a fairly good price, but they're real sporadic in their numbers wherever they're found, and especially this far south, they're more sporadic than farther north. There are years when they're all over. They're just lots. And that particular time, you would do pretty well, particularly if the price was high. But the kids and the weasels, when the weasels come around, they give each kid a little trap and let him set his trap to try to catch the weasels. So that's how most of the people that live in this group come to get into trapping. They learn kind of early. At the same time, there's not a way of getting around the few fur animals that you have available to you here. It's not like other places in the interior where you can depend on trapping for making a full year life out of.
I assume that you'd hunt caribou in the winter?
Well, that's true. Of course, that's a story in itself. Caribou are one of the most choice animals of the region. When they're around, everybody is happy because you have a good supply of good meat. At the turn of the century, the caribou had disappeared from this area. That's why reindeer were introduced here. But around the time that I got here, caribou started to come back, and the first moose was killed here that people had ever seen before. That would have been in 48, 49. Though there's been ups and downs, caribou populations have been pretty much building ever since then, up until this last 8-10 years, when everybody had been warning, well, the crash is going to come, the population is going to drop right down. But it hasn't. It stayed at a level for an extremely long time. Of course, there are Eskimo people who existed solely off of caribou herd because they supply so much of your basic needs. So you add caribou to the animals that are here and your life becomes much easier and long. A lot of good meat to eat first for making cold weather clothes. Caribou is a very wonderful animal when it's here, and they were here and building all through this period that I've been here. The first few winters I was here, there were no caribou came through here locally, but it was only maybe 3 years after I'd been here that the first caribou, maybe in this century, did make a normal migration trip. We were over there fishing, of course, at that time, and that run comes just like now around the 1st of October. So we began to have caribou available then every fall in their migration through. Prior to that, we talked about some people having teams strong enough and ambition enough to go north up Noatak or somewhere up in the higher areas for wolf and wolverine hunting. But caribou would really be the main reason they would go there. In March, when the days are longer, people would make a trip back up into the Noatak River in order to bring some caribou meat and skin home. That's an indication of how important the caribou were. And of course, to have the caribou coming back in huge numbers has all been real great. In the line of that caribou hunting, you can't separate the trapping activity in this region from caribou hunting, because if you're up there caribou hunting, you always take a dozen traps along with four foxes.
How about some of the other marine mammals? Talked a little bit about belugas. Did you have extensive experience with them?
How many hours you got left? Well, that's a pet thing on my mind at this time, and I'm tempted to tell you my theory as to why they're not here anymore, but I don't think I will. I need a few more nails to make my theory hold water. There's two communities in the Kotzebue Sound region that were oriented specifically to beluga. At Noatak, the whole village would move down to the point right over here intact. Nobody left home in the village at all. And the purpose of coming down here was to drive beluga between here and Kotzebue and to put up muckduck for their winter. The other community is the Buckland area. Buckland is a kind of a natural trap down there. They have shallow water, deep water all around. All you have to do is wait till you see some beluga inside there, and then when they're in shallow water, they're relatively easy to catch. Here in Kotzebue, you have the shallow water, but normally the beluga don't go into the shallow water of their own accord. You would anchor your boat between here and Kotzebue out on the edge of shallow water, and everything's silent. Just wait for these huge groups of sometimes 100, 200 beluga to work their way in, and then when they get past where your boats are anchored, then everybody work together and drive them farther into shallow water. And there's all kinds of interesting old stories of what happened in some of those drives when they had no engines at all and drove them with kayaks and skin books. One time while they were driving them into shallow water, one fellow was with them and with the kayak noticed a group of dark colored belugas. Young one had turned off and was headed on their own up that way, and everybody else was following the nice big white ones just this way. So he took matters in his own hand and he tailed along behind them. When they got into shallow water, their back beginning to show above the water. Well, he just got out of his kayak and started walking around and poking them with a knife right at that point where the neck meets the skull, and killed quite a number. Even though, of course, they were small ones, he had a lot of muckduck after that example. That's one of the stories that come out of it. Early on, the people here, the first engine boats they had were those that they called one-lungers, inboard engines. There were several of them around, and enough to take part in a beluga drive. So the kayaks and the skin boats and those engine boats would drive them into shallow water and catch them there. Everybody had enough. The rack over to Newark would be just white with beluga muckduck hanging. Then you come to the era of about where I come in, only a little earlier than that. They got first outboards here, Johnson 10 horse, that sort of thing. And the drive method continued to another few years down the line when outboards were bigger up. Some things changed what I was talking about earlier when there was no money in the country. One of the things was the salmon fishing that come on somewhere around there that did bring a good deal of money into the country. And working together and driving the belugas into shallow water, which was tried for centuries and worked real well even without engines, everybody dropped that and it became every man for himself when more people got their own personal outboards. This is the beginning of my explanation of what happened. After a few years, we began to see less and less belugas here in a place named Place of White Whales. Somewhere back along there was one day when 150 were taken between here and Kotzebue by Kotzebue and Shisholik people. But after that, locally here, you began to see less and less, and later, beluga from Shisholik. There's salmon fishery set up here, and a lot of people did real well, including us. That's where this dome come from. I partnered with a guy from Ambler, and we got into commercial fishing here, and that's how we got rich, as rich as we ever got. Early on, when the beluga come in, they come in right as soon as there begins to be cracks developing in the ice. They come in through the narrow track. We that live here in Shisholik, as opposed to those that would move down after Noatak River ice went out, had the opportunity to use our kayaks to paddle out on the edge of an ice floe, get down from the kayak and wait for a beluga to come up twice in the same place so you can shoot it. They're a little hard to hunt because they don't show above the surface, but it did work pretty well at that time. And I was here early enough to take part in that. Several belugas right here off the beach with a kayak. A neighbor over here, an old man that's gone now, we had a very deep friendship between he and I. We hunted a lot together. And in one spring, right from his camp over there, he took eight beluga, just shooting them from the beach with a quite a, and hooks to recover them with. As the years traveled on here up to the present time, beluga had gotten scarcer and scarcer here in Kotzebue Sound. Everybody's wondering what the reason was. Pretty soon, the management people did get into it. The state, of course, at first, and then the federal government took over management of marine mammals, the Marine Mammal Act, which, by the way, excluded me from my chosen livelihood. It had technically become illegal for me to hunt marine mammals.
And that being because you're white?
Right. I don't want to give the impression that that became a hardship to me. It didn't, and besides that, it wasn't enforced. We had other means of income rather than selling seal oil by the time that came on, which was salmon fishing. And again, with this guy I partnered with from up there, and we did pretty good in that. So incorporated into the law by special permission, being married to an Eskimo, you could continue your livelihood, but there was no enforcement on it anyway.
Great insight on beluga biology from Bob Ewell. That's all for today's episode of Alaska Tracks. Tune in again next week at this time for another episode.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.